Greetings, humans, and welcome to the At the Bar podcast powered by Hanson Reynolds. I'm Tim Hanson. With me here, as always, is my partner, Toby Reynolds, and the law firm's newest partner, Matt Gavronsky. Not only the newest partner, but spearheading a brand new practice area for Hanson Reynolds. He's going to be running our patent prosecution and intellectual property group. So welcome, Matthew.
Thank you, Tim. Toby, excited to be here.
And I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm introducing a new segment, Overrated, Underrated. So I have an overrated. I haven't really thought of an underrated one yet, but I'll kick it off. I had it in my head, and then I was going to switch it to turkey. But I'm not so sure that turkey's underrated because enough people hate it that I'm just punching down at that point. But turkey sucks. But overrated, grossly overrated, fucking lobster.
Agree.
I mean, it's super expensive.
Yep.
It's hard to cook. Most people overcook it. If you undercook it, it's probably toxic. I don't think it tastes that great. I mean, it's all about, you know, drawn butter and other accoutrement for it. I just think it's worthless.
I've never understood lobster. Never. Never understood for all the same reasons. My preferred shellfish is the king crab, which I don't think it's over or underrated. No. I think it's properly rated.
And it's priced accordingly.
Yes.
The big legs, I mean, those are awesome.
Yes.
But fantastic. I will say another one, though, that I hate. I don't know if it's over or underrated, but just like, you know, Maryland crabs, ripping them open, scooping out their stomachs for half an ounce of mediocre meat.
Again, same with you. I'm with you 100% on that.
Toby?
I'm not a huge lobster fan, no matter what, although I did one time have an Australian lobster tail that was grilled, and it was fantastic. But generally, I'm not a big lobster fan. The interesting thing about that subject, though, is that my father's best friend growing up was from a very poor family in Racine or Kenosha. I think it was Racine. And he hated lobster because as a kid, they ate so much lobster, he just couldn't stomach it anymore. And the reason was, is at that time, lobster was like cheap
food.
Yeah,
it was garbage food.
Yeah, garbage food. And I don't know what changed. I don't know if it was a marketing thing by New England Lobstermen or what happened.
Something happened.
It went from being like poor people food to being this delicacy.
Who was the brave soul that ate the first lobster?
Yeah.
Because when that fucker crawls out of the ocean, I mean, who would...
I'm not touching that thing.
Anyway. All right. First episode of the new segment down.
Yeah, right. Right, exactly.
Lobster.
Came right out of the gates with that one. That directly relates to patent prosecution. No, the point of this, though, is that we don't need to have this be a specific podcast about patent prosecution or anything else. It's really to find out more about you, Matt. That's the way we do all these podcasts. This is a little bit unique, I guess, in that we have done podcasts with two or three members of our firm before, but this happens to be a podcast with a, as you said, Tim, the newest member of the firm. But that's not the point of it. So we're not doing this, you know, as a introduction to the world of Matt Gavronsky. It's more just that it seemed to make sense. You were in Milwaukee today, and
we did a
podcast. Yeah, yeah, exactly. We're pretty hungry for guests.
I presented convenient, and you guys needed some content.
We have a content issue. Yeah.
So give us your background though to start off. We always kind of do some of that, and part of that for me that would be interesting is I know how I first met you, how you came into Michael Best as a patent engineer. But give a little background and give us a little bit about whether law was ever on your radar until sort of that experience.
And please start with your birth weight.
Yeah.
My birth weight. Way back.
You know, it's funny. I remember this only because I had a plaque in my bedroom. It's about that big. Birthday, birth weight. And it had, you know, length, I guess, but I don't remember the length. But I was exactly 8 pounds. 8 pounds, 0 ounces.
Born to be an engineer.
Yes.
Precision.
November 7th, 1977, which has always been interesting. 11-7-77 is nice ring to it.
And exactly the weight of a gallon of water.
Water 8?
Water is 8 pounds.
Fuel
or 11-7.
I had in my head that it was 6, but that's fuel. Okay, let's see. Well, if we're starting with birth weight, beginning at the beginning, let's see. I was born in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. I lived there until I was about 4, and then my parents moved to Appleton, Wisconsin. For family reasons, and that's really where I grew up and was raised. Catholic schools my entire life until I went to law school, actually. So grade school, Xavier High School in Appleton, wonderful school. And then I did my undergraduate work at Marquette University right here in Milwaukee. I think it was probably physics class in high school where I had always liked putting things together and working with my hands, fixing things, made some cool stuff, I think, when I was probably 10 or 12 that I'm pretty proud of, but I won't bore you guys with.
Quantum computer.
Landluge, actually. Remember Landluging?
No.
No?
No.
So it was like the original, it was like the very first X Games. And it's basically a really long skateboard that you would lay on your back on, and you would take it down a hill. And I made one of those out of an old skateboard and some 2x4s, and it worked alarmingly well. And I thought, maybe I'm onto something here. And then it was physics class in high school where I kind of took to mechanics and engineering and the math side of being able to predict, you know, how far a cannonball would fly and things like that. So went to Marquette, got my mechanical engineering degree, and while I was at Marquette, it's really funny how all these different things that happen to you in life kind of lead you down a certain path. And early in my time at Marquette, I was working with a vintage Mustang race team. It was just a private team where they had 7 race cars, a well-funded individual. But it was a hobby for this gentleman, but I was fortunate enough to work on that team, got close to race cars, got to understand that stuff, and just was working on a team of very diverse backgrounds on the team, and just learned a lot about that. And that experience directly contributed to my getting the job at Harley-Davidson as a co-op engineer at Harley-Davidson here in Milwaukee while I was working on my mechanical engineering degree. So I had that experience, carried that through the first, what ended up being 5 years of undergrad. It was supposed to be 5 years. That was the plan with the co-op program.
Lots of people go to college for 7 years. Yeah, they're called doctors.
But that was the original plan. And then, it was around 2000, going into my super senior year of undergrad, starting to think about a job. And there was a little dip in the economy at the time, and Harley-Davidson put a hiring freeze in place. And so I'd always assumed that after I graduated, and my boss at Harley-Davidson had communicated this to me as well, that, you know, there was a position ready for me, and I would be able to join that team and continue working on some really cool motorcycles.
What year was this?
2000. So I graduated in 2001. So, right, you're thinking about jobs and stuff, the spring of 2000, fall of 2000. And I'll never forget, I was living in the fraternity house at the time, Sigma Phi Delta, Eta Chapter. And I got a letter in the mail from a law firm that at the time I'd never heard of because I didn't have any interest in going into the law, quite frankly. It wasn't even remotely on my radar. And when you're, a 22-year-old kid getting ready to graduate high school and a letter from a law firm shows up, it's not really a good thing. I didn't know what that could be. What is this? So I open it up and, the letter's like, it was from Michael Best and Friedrich. Probably a lot of listeners familiar with that firm here in Milwaukee. And they were hiring what they called patent engineers. And they were looking for, they were hiring students directly out of undergrad, kind of looking for people who maybe weren't thinking about going into law school. My understanding, I learned this after the fact, was that around that time, it had become very difficult for patent prosecution firms to recruit patent prosecution attorneys because there aren't a lot of attorneys who also have the science and technical background that's required to sit for the patent bar and eventually become a patent attorney. And so the strategy of Michael Best, and I think some other firms were realizing this at the time, was why don't we just go snatch them right out of undergrad and we can teach them, train them as patent agents who are able to prosecute patents. And when I say prosecute patents, you guys know this, but maybe the listeners don't. That's the process of writing the patent and then arguing the patent, arguing about the patent and what the scope of the patent should be with the patent office. So I got the letter from Michael Best. They invited us up to their very nice offices at the top. You guys are both familiar with them. At the top of what was the address? That was the 100 East building, right? And, I went in and I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea. They're just like, come to this reception for patent engineer candidates. And, I go in. I'm like, wow, this is one of the tallest buildings in the city. And then I go in, I'm like, 33rd floor. And I go, oh, I'm like, holy cow, that's the top floor of the building. All right, I'm getting on the elevator, and it's this long ride up, and it opens up, and the marble floors and the woodwork, and right, so from a kid, coming out of, the Harley-Davidson Engineering Center, which is beautiful in its own right, this was just a very different and striking experience. And so I went there, met a bunch of the attorneys. But I think the key to my getting hired was that Harley-Davidson was a client of Michael Best and Friedrich. Mm. And the attorney who was managing all the Harley-Davidson work, we found each other. And we were able to start talking about all of the top secret things that no one else knew about because we were working, I had been working on the engineering side and they were working on the patents. And so that was sort of made me memorable. I think, in the eyes of them. So ultimately, I did, as you guys know, because we worked there together, I did get hired as a member of the very first class of patent engineers at Michael Best and Friedrich. And that started my journey in the law, so to speak. I carried on with that for about 3 years, I think it was, before I decided, I think it makes sense to go to law school.
So what year to what year were you a patent engineer?
So I was a patent engineer from 2001 until 2003. I think it was three. Got to do the math. Yeah.
And Toby, you were already there?
Yeah, I joined Michael Best in 2000. So I remember that reception really well. I don't remember, I don't know if you remember, Matt, did was that the end of it, or did you get brought back for interviews?
There was another round of interviews. So I think of the 30 or 40 engineers that were there, I think they called back either six or maybe eight of us for interviews, and then there were the four of us that made the cut, I guess.
And we had others of those receptions, but I can't remember if we had more than one that year or if there were other years. So I can't remember if there was more than one reception that year.
My recollection was that there was basically one a year.
Okay.
And that there were, and I assume have continued to be, patent engineer classes basically almost every year. I don't know. From the time I was there, I think there was four of us the first year. And I'm going, this is deep into the memory banks, but it was like four, then two, then maybe three. And then I think there was a big year where it was like five or six. Mm. And I know that program has grown and been very successful.
It was an interesting idea. It was, I think, clearly a successful idea. Like you said, I think Michael Best kind of was the first of the bigger firms to really go all out and in earnest hire engineers to be patent engineers and then go get their, pass the patent bar and become patent agents and then maybe go to law school and become patent lawyers. There had been patent agents out there in the Milwaukee market at big firms forever, but there were like one and two here and there.
Yeah.
But this idea of bringing in this class of, top graduates to come in and kind of groom them to be patent lawyers, I think was a new thing. It was even within the firm a little bit controversial because I remember some young associates call it NAFTA, right? Because they were like,
I kind of want to hear from Tim too. Is you were a summer associate at the time?
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
Yeah. Summer of 2001. I just remember the engineers were just always around, and at that time, that was before 9/11 and the recession and all that stuff. So it was like the last old school crazy party scene of the summer associates just getting wined and dined. I didn't pay for a single meal for an entire summer, and you guys were always
there
in the mix. Like, hello,
taking advantage. Yeah, absolutely.
So I had no idea what you people did other than party with me. So
you probably didn't realize that was a new thing or anything, right?
I mean, I knew they were patent engineers and had a different role at the firm, but I had no idea that it was this novel concept or relatively novel concept that kind of took off.
Yeah. And you guys started right upon graduation, right?
So I started before. I think I started in March.
Okay.
I think it was like March of the year that I graduated. So by the time I graduated, I'd been like part-time, right? You know, working around my class schedule. But yeah, I think a couple others did. Actually, Paul McGinley, a friend of ours, who you guys also both know, he and I started on the exact same day. And I should have him on, and maybe he'll tell the story of our first training session together. He was all very prim and proper, and for whatever reason, I guess I was overconfident, but I was kind of leaned back in the chair and had my feet up, and it was very casual. He's like, who's this guy?
Flip-flops, cut-off jean shorts. It was a look.
You know, yeah, but that was, so you guys were all working summer of 2001 already when Tim was the summer.
Yeah, they were definitely, definitely there.
Yeah.
Well, and I remember everybody.
But you're brand new.
There was this big anticipation. You know, we didn't know, right? I had no idea how any of this worked. It was all totally new. And there was just this big anticipation. You know, the summers were arriving and the first, you know, they kind of, there's a couple weeks, depending on what school you're coming from. You know, the first ones arrive, you know, week, whatever. And then, you know, over the course of 3 weeks, everybody shows up. And I just remember all the anticipation. And I'm like, this sounds like it's going to be really cool. And it pretty much met all expectations. Like,
if I go and hang out with these idiot loser law students, I get free stuff. I get free drinks and free food.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Yeah, it was fun. Those were great years. I learned a lot. Learned a lot from Toby. I mean, Toby was one of my, you know, original mentors.
Bullshit. Go ahead.
Side. And yeah, it was a great time. And then so what did we get to? Like 2003? I think we figured it out.
Mm-hmm. By the way, one real quick thing to go back to. I'm curious because you dropped this that I had never heard before. You were born in Rapids and were there until you were four.
Yeah,
you never ran into McGinley at that time, right? You're like preschool or something like that.
Yeah, no, I have very little in the way of memory. Well, I guess, and for the listeners, Paul McGinley is also from Wisconsin Rapids.
Yeah,
but that's just a matter of chance. No, I have very little in the way of memories from Wisconsin Rapids. I remember we had a large woods in our backyard that was fun to run around in, and now in hindsight, it probably wasn't big at all. It was probably just like 10 trees.
Yeah,
but you know, I was 3 or 4 years old. So it seemed like the 100-acre wood to me. The 2003, off to law school at University of Wisconsin of Madison, taking full advantage of the in-state tuition and the diploma privilege, I should say, although I ruined that when I ended up going to Illinois. Very fun, but hardworking years in Madison.
And you worked for Michael Best Madison while you were in law school.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right. One of the interesting things, I've said it before, like Michael Best is sort of, I worked in the Milwaukee office. I worked in the Madison office while I was in law school. And then when I finished law school, I ended up in the Michael Best Chicago office. So I ended up working in what at the time were, I think, the only three offices that they had back in the early 2000s. I know they've expanded significantly.
Don't sleep on Lehigh Valley.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, you never worked in Manitowoc, did you?
Right. But having that experience and meeting all of those attorneys and learning from all of those attorneys, it's still very connected to the Michael Best firm, and certainly still have a number of very good friends there.
Was it a formal program where you would go to law school and work at the firm and get a job as a lawyer afterwards? Or was it more just an informal, like, hey, you go to law school, so, and maybe we'll hire you?
there was this brief period where I think the original, maybe there were 6 or 8 of us at the time, tried to convince them that, you know, you guys should really help pay for our law school. And
we got all that free drinks during dance in summer. We sort of figured, you know.
So, you know, we proposed it, and they came back with an offer that was not the best offer. So I went to law school sort of my own motivation and funding. But it was, I'd had enough discussions and I'd worked with enough of the partners that I wasn't worried about it. And they all said, yeah, just keep doing work, you know, show up. So I did. I worked part-time through all of law school. For the summers, I would come back to Milwaukee because that's where the big parties were. Although Madison had some really good events too. I should mention that. But
you did live in Milwaukee those summers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, my right. First summer.
Probably a significant number of nights on your couch.
Well, no, it was I roomed my first summer, I believe it was after my first year of law school, was with Lucas Thomas.
Yeah, that's what I was.
You also roomed with him.
Also
a former
roommate
of
mine.
I know, right? So Lucas is LT. Like, he's tied in.
You out there, Lucas?
To this whole thing.
This is getting really ugly, right? In terms of how many connections are. Matt has lived with Tim, has lived with me. Grew up with Paul McGinley. We didn't know it.
So do you take a bunch of different classes in law school knowing that you're going to be a patent lawyer?
I focused my curriculum accordingly. And
nothing on Friday.
So I did. It was nice. I'll say this. I had a lot of close friends in law school who, who gave me a lot of shit about the situation I found myself in. They're like, wait, so you basically got a job already when you graduate? And I'm like, I mean, it's not guaranteed, but yeah, as long as I don't mess up, I think it was Dave Price. He's like, just don't fail. Like, just don't mess it up.
Setting the bar high.
I took the IP classes and the patent classes and the trademark classes. I kind of knew what I wanted to get into, which was kind of nice. Just being able to zero in on that. I took like a psychology in the law class, you know, some of the more flighty, fanciful ones that were, you know, that I knew would hopefully not hurt the GPA too much. My kind of funny story about that and focusing on patent stuff is it fit really well in the schedule, and a bunch of my friends and I, we all agreed to take it, and it was BizOrgs 1. And it was actually taught by the dean of the law school at the time. But like I said, the schedule was good. And we're like, yeah, sure, well, I'll take BizOrgs 1. And I go into that class just being like, I just got to pass this one. It doesn't really matter. And I wasn't paying the most attention to it. And comes time, we get to the final. And I kind of study. And it was either second or it must have been third year. Whenever they let you start like pass-failing classes. And so I'm like, I'll pass fail BizOrgs. I don't need to worry about that too much. And I lightly study just to make sure I'm going to pass and sit down. I take the test. I'm taking the test. I'm like, man, I'm really like, this seems, I think I'm doing okay here. And I just kind of cruising through it and I get done. I don't really think anything of it. And, grades come out, it's pass fail and you can call in or email. I can't remember how it was at the time, but anyway, you can find out like what your grade would have been had you not pass-failed the class. And I called and I found it. It would have been my highest grade in law school by a substantial margin.
You fool!
I was like, son, I messed it up.
They say in law school, you know, that the courses you think you did poorly in, or the exams you think you did poorly in, you do well in, and vice versa. And the reason is because you're spotting all these issues, you're hashing through it, you're thinking about it all, you get a good grade. But I think that, I mean, and they even say that in other essay writing classes in college, but I think law school more than any place, that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go in and you are kind of, you know, you kind of just let it all go and you just sort of let the question flow through you, mm-hmm. you know, it seems like you do the best. And I'm sure that it's not a complete coincidence that you were doing a pass fail.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely part of it. I think I learned a lesson that although a little too late to be able to apply it to the rest of my law school, but
barely study.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's the lesson.
Don't try so hard.
same thing happened for me, and I think I told you in an English class. I was one of the few engineers at Brown who took an English class. You didn't have to, and I had the same thing where I took this English class, pass fail, and it just was sort of freeing. And I wrote these essays that were just off the wall, you know, just crazy stuff. I thought, but I got an A in the class, and I think I got the highest grade in that class because you just sort of, you know, you don't worry about, I think as engineers too, at law school, essay writing classes, like my English class I'm talking about in college, you sort of have this belief of, I got to be careful and give the right answer. And a lot of times essay writing, it's the exact opposite strategy should be taken.
Yeah. Yeah. The law school questions, like trying to answer the question, like structuring it.
Yeah.
That engineer mentality definitely, I think, was not so helpful in law school.
Hmm. I agree. I think that it's a little weird because they say engineers that I think non-engineers think that it's a perfect mentality to have for law school because it is true. You sort of find the rule, sort of the black letter law thing, you know, IRAC, issue, rule, application, conclusion, and sort of be analytical about it. But I think that that the flip side is that you can get too structured sort of in what, because most law professors aren't that analytical. Most law professors are not structured quite that to that degree.
Yeah, I didn't have any of that.
No? No. You were Iowa, right?
Iowa undergrad and law school. I think I knew when I shit the bed on a test and did well.
So you did not partake of the Michael Best go to law school plan at all, huh? I didn't realize that.
No, I know they have one now. I don't know. I don't know much about it. I've heard about it.
Well, weren't you in the mix, though, in... Well, like you said, they put together what you found not to be too attractive of a plan, but I remember that first group of patent engineers seemed to be talking to the highest levels of the firm about trying to put a program together all the time, right? So you were part of the structuring of it, but it just didn't...
Yeah. Okay. So I think, you know, again, we were the first ones to kind of present it. And in the defense of the leadership of Michael Best at the time, they didn't know how this was going to work out, right? I mean, they had no idea. So, and I was the first one to go. And I know, I think Dr. Chan, did Dr. Chan end up going to law school? I forget. I thought maybe.
I think he did. Yeah. Well, no, I'm not sure about that. I take that back. I think he might've been a patent. I think he might've taken the patent bar, but I think he was a patent agent and he's been at McAndrews Held and Malloy in Chicago forever.
That's true. That's right.
I think he's a patent agent though.
So, yeah. So I mean, I was again part of the first class and then I was the first one to leave to go to law school. And then again, ultimately came back to the firm when I graduated in 2006. Worked out at the Chicago office for six or seven years. I forget the exact date as I sit here. But then I was followed by a couple other patent engineers who went on to law school and then came back to the firm. And I think over time they're like, okay, yeah, this thing works. And it probably does make sense for us to incentivize these people, you know, and I don't know if they have a selection process for it or how they do it, but I do know that there is something in place now that is a pretty good deal for the engineers who want to go to law school where there's some tuition assistance.
And a pretty good gig coming out of engineering school, right? Like the comp structure and everything.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, that letter that I mentioned earlier, right? I mean... The pay was higher than anything that you were going to see in an engineering job by probably, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 at the time, which then is more than 10%. They're like, here's what your pay is going to be. You're going to get a secretary and you're going to get an office. And again, For an engineering, you know, major who's coming up thinking I'm going to be in a cubicle sitting behind a computer, you know, working for somebody, it was like, well, yeah, I'm definitely going to go check that out. I've never even thought about being a lawyer before in my life, but that is a compelling situation.
Could you have stayed as an engineer, or was the idea that you really needed to go to law school to satisfy, you know, the expectations at the firm?
That was entirely my own kind of decision. Everybody that I asked, they're like, we don't care what you do, man. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to stay, you can stay and be an engineer. And they said, to their credit, they said, we've tried to structure this in a way that remained, you know, being a patent engineer is a viable, you know, lifelong career path. And I think if you look at the roster that they have today, that it bears that out. I know some of my earliest colleagues are still with the firm and are still engineers and have been very successful in that line of work. But, you know, I just kind of made the decision. I was like, I think I want to go do this law school thing and try my hand at being a lawyer.
And then you went to McDermott, Will and Emery after a few years in Chicago, yep. right? Now, did they have this? Did they have patent agents at McDermott? Do you know whether big prosecution groups then or now had patent agents?
So, the Chicago office of McDermott, Will and Emery did not. I think one of the California offices may have had a couple. Everybody that I worked with in the Chicago office of McDermott, Will and Emery was an attorney, a patent mm-hmm. attorney.
How did that move come about?
I was headhunted.
Yeah.
And I was headhunted. They were looking for a mechanical engineer, experienced mechanical engineering, patent attorneys to come over. And I went there and worked with just another really fantastic, group of attorneys. Kind of interesting. A lot of, McDermott had, similar to what you have, Toby, they had a lot of guys that were sort of, both litigators and prosecutors. Mm. So guys that had a mixed practice, where they weren't necessarily just, one or the other, which you see in a lot of places, but there were a few attorneys there who practiced that way. They had ongoing litigation, and then they also had patent prosecution clients, and some of those were the same, and sometimes they were different. But my time at McDermott, and I to this day I feel kind of bad about it, but my time at McDermott was short because a client that I was working extensively on while I was with McDermott, Will and Emery, was Clover. At the time, it was Clover Technologies Group. For a while, it was Clover Imaging Group. Now it's Clover Environmental Solutions. But I was working quite a bit on their on some design around work for them. They had gotten tangled up in a lawsuit, and we were working on what the design around was going to be that was going to allow them, to continue to do their business. And in the course of that, I developed a relationship with one of the senior engineers there, and I kind of just mentioned to him off the cuff, I was like, John, do you guys ever think about in-house counsel? Because I think it might be a good idea for a company of their size. Very large company at the time. They had, I think, one, maybe two attorneys in-house at the time. And that just kind of snowballed. I think the timing was right. And I moved in-house with Clover in 2013 and set up basically an in-house patent prosecution practice there where they had been spending, McDermott dollars. let's just call it what it is. They were spending McDermott dollars on patent prosecution. And so I was able to take basically all of that work. We moved it in-house. I found a wonderful, wonderful IP paralegal who I was able to work with. And we set up the whole program. So we had trademark, a sizable trademark portfolio, a sizable patent portfolio. Doing a lot of clearance work, doing a lot of, there were some cease and desist letters. We had accusations coming in that we were responding to. It was really just it was a really fun time in my career because I was able kind of for the first time to take total control of a practice and kind of manage it the way that I thought it should be managed.
Foreshadowing.
What I learned, the biggest lesson that I took away from that was, surround yourself with the best people that you can. Because, like I said, having Joan, I doubt she's listening, but she's out there.
Come on, Joan, tune in.
She was wonderful, and we were a great team, and we were very successful in setting that practice up and building it. Now, a lot changed over the years. Eventually the company kind of split into two. There was a wireless division and an imaging division.
Well, what all did Clover do?
So Clover, business? Yeah, I guess we'll talk about that a little bit because that's interesting. So Clover started out in a garage in Marseilles, Illinois. I don't even know if I'm saying that right. Very rural in like 96. And the guy started refilling printer cartridges. So taking it, putting in new toner and reselling them. And that was kind of the start of the business, and it grew over time. It grew significantly over time, and Their primary business for a long time was cartridge, printer cartridge remanufacturing. So toner cartridges, ink cartridges. They expanded. They were one of the fastest growing companies in like the Chicagoland area in, I think it was like the early 2000s. In that time frame, and they were growing very rapidly. They made an acquisition of a company that was remanufacturing cell phones at the time, primarily iPhones. And so when I joined in 2013 was right about the time that they had just purchased the cell phone refurbishment business. And at that point, the company was almost $1 billion. I think it might have been $1 billion at one point in that time period. And
did it purchase that because the toner cartridge remanufacturing thing was kind of already on its way out?
No. I don't think that was part of the strategy at that point. It was really a diversification play. Like, you know, we're the thing, and this is still the case with Clover. Like, Clover is extremely good at bringing assets back and then sorting through them, finding the valuable stuff and remarketing the stuff that's valuable, and then efficiently and responsibly disposing of, recycling the stuff that's not valuable.
It's like Rey from Star Wars.
Yeah. Yes. The scavenger. Indeed. And so that was, that was the time when I came into Clover. Ultimately, it became apparent that the wireless and the imaging business weren't as complementary, I think, as everyone had hoped. And so they decided to divest the two, and I ended up staying with the imaging business as the general counsel. And so, and I had been learning over the years, working under my general counsel at the time, but it just, that exposed me to a whole different world. Of contracts and real estate and insurance and all of these other sort of general corporate areas of practice that hadn't really been part of my what you would call upbringing as an attorney, but that I nonetheless found very interesting, very fulfilling, and it was a very enjoyable time in my career. And then I guess we're coming up on the basketball game. What was it, March of last year?
Oh yeah, that's right. I guess that was the Bulls game you're talking about. Yeah.
Yep.
Bulls Bucks game.
And I had Toby's like, "Hey, I'm going to be in Chicago. Do you want to go to a Bulls game?" And we went. Was Paul there for that?
I think he was. Yeah.
I think he was. And Al probably.
Yep.
And that was the first time that Toby mentioned to me the possibility of joining Hanson Reynolds.
Yeah, there was a whole, now that I think about that you're exactly right. There was a whole lot going on right at that moment. And I can't remember if I had had, I mean, I obviously in some way I'd had the idea for a very long time of bringing you aboard, but there was something I feel like, I think I even said to you literally the week before something had happened or whatever. I'm not exactly sure that I'd even, no, I think we had scheduled that basketball game specifically to talk about something like this. But yeah, it was kind of incredible because it was one of those moments where we had a discussion, and a lot of times you have discussions like that and then you just, nobody ever follows up, and we both followed up and it was pretty clear. Yeah, this isn't a 20% pie in the sky thing. This is a 90% likely to happen thing.
Well, we had other, we had had other opportunities that, onboarding a patent prosecution practice that for various reasons didn't materialize. So it was definitely in our consciousness
right.
That it was something we wanted to do. And so, yeah, it was, just fortuitous timing.
Yeah.
So back to Clover, though, what remanufacturing just in the world is going on? Like, for example, is printer toner cartridges still something that is remanufactured and you can buy remanufactured, refilled toner cartridges?
Yes, absolutely.
And, okay. Is it as big a business as it was 10 years ago?
No,
okay.
No, it's not. And COVID accelerated the decline. It's not a secret. That one of the interesting things about working for Clover is the printer cartridge industry has its own little cottage press, like newsletters and magazines that are dedicated just to the print industry. And it's a very interesting cast of characters.
Not the print industry, but just the printer.
The journalists who cover the print industry.
Just the printers, yeah.
You know, there's a couple websites and like I said, newsletters, and there's a YouTube personality.
That convention must be exciting.
But you know, people that are very, very interested in that. But it's. I'm not disclosing any secrets when I say that COVID. You know, when everybody went, just think about it, right? Everybody's in the office and everybody's pumping documents to the office printers. Now everybody goes home.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody's printing anymore. Right. Just the amount of printing that was happening, you know, was already in decline because more people were going to like virtual systems and all of that. But COVID just really accelerated that, and so the printer cartridge remanufacturing has been in decline. Now, I will say, if you would like to buy an environmentally friendly Clover remanufactured printer cartridge, you can. They're at Staples. There are a lot of private label brands.
Okay.
So Staples brands are Clover cartridges, Office Max.
Okay.
Clover cartridges there.
And are all the IP issues settled in that regard? I mean, for a while, I thought that was going to be part of the demise, right? Was that there was this question about whether you are refurbishing or remanufacturing. Is that right?
Yeah, impermissible repair versus permissible repair versus impermissible reconstruction.
Because as you can imagine, you buy something that has a patent on it and you basically change something insignificant and try to resell it. There's a lot there. I guess I won't get too far into the weeds on it, but the point is you can't sell a product that infringes somebody else's patent when you basically have built a whole new version of it.
Mm. Right, right. And you know, there've been some good cases on that. Not again getting into the weeds, but like the Jazz Photo case, which was overruled with respect to the first sale doctrine, but was actually very and is still really good law with respect to the scope of how much repair you can do, like how many components can you replace, and that one was about disposable cameras. Remember those back when we still had film?
Yeah.
Back when that was still a thing.
Those kind of came back around, though.
Yeah, they did. It's funny, right?
Yeah. Polaroids
are still there, right? There was a lot. The facts in that case were there was a pretty significant, rebuilding of that disposable camera taking place that was held to be a permissible repair. It was overruled on the first sale doctrine. Jazz Photo had said that for the patent rights to be exhausted, right? So that is when I buy something. And Toby's got his phone on the table, right? When you buy the iPhone, you, the purchaser, now have a right to use all of those patents, right? It just makes sense that once you buy something, those patent rights are exhausted with respect to that device, and you're allowed to make use of all of the patents that might cover it.
The first buyer.
Yeah, but that carries through to subsequent buyers as well. And so what Jazz Photo had said was, in order for that first sale to be an exhausting first sale, is it needs to take place in the United States. So Clover at the time had to have significant collection programs for printer cartridges and, when they were doing cell phones, to make sure that all of those cartridges they were collecting were coming from U.S. sources. Mm. You had to have documentation that, you know, I picked this one up in New Jersey, and I picked this one up in Idaho, you know, maybe from Lucas Thomas.
Notorious infringer.
Yes. But that the Impression Products case.
But it can't come from Costa Rica in
right,
Lucas Thomas.
Right. The Impression Products case did away with all of that. And now in the U.S., we observe global patent exhaustion. So any device sold anywhere in the world exhausts the patent rights with respect to that, that exhausts the U.S. patent rights with respect to that item, which made Clover's collections much easier.
So what else out there is remanufactured these days?
So, I mean, a lot of auto parts.
Okay.
So there's a pretty significant, and I'll mess up the acronym, but there's a pretty large group of remanufacturers of auto parts. Hmm. And these are your sort of your a lot of the engine accessories, right, what I would call them being car guys. So like alternators and starters, power steering pumps, things like that that might fail, you know, after 80 or 100,000 miles with some regularity, but that don't necessarily change a whole lot either over the years. So there are a lot of companies that will then take those, take them apart, you know, redo the windings on the alternator or, refurbish the seals or replace the seals on a pump, things like that. There's a lot of remanufacturing happening there. Another big area, I mean, cell phones are still, there's still a very strong market for refurbished cell phones. Hmm. I actually don't know if this is still the case, but it probably is, I suspect. But a lot of the carriers, when you have a warranty plan on your phone where it's just, oh, if your phone breaks, just bring it to the store, we'll hand you a new one. Not quite true. That's not a new phone. A lot of cases, that's actually a refurbished phone. That's a phone that has been refurbished back to basically like new condition, which is one of the biggest challenges for one of the biggest challenges for remanufacturers of cell phones is getting them back, taking a device that has been out in the wild and it's got scratches and getting that back into a like new.
Doesn't Apple even themselves sell, like if you crack your screen, or I thought I saw something even on like the Apple website that you can get a refurbished phone.
I have seen that Apple is doing that. Again, I'm not super familiar with the state of things today. Yeah. There's a lot of effort, and I'm probably going to get it not quite right, but I know California, I think, just passed a pretty significant right to repair legislation. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting bills that I followed. I didn't have to follow it so closely once I was on the imaging side of things, because with the print cartridges, we had it figured out. We had it dialed in. We knew where to get parts. We knew how to avoid the OEM patents. We could design around that stuff. We had a very robust system in place that kind of kept us out of trouble. With a higher tech device like a phone, I don't know if you guys may have heard this, but Apple started tying the components to the device. And it was really the first one, I think, that was the big challenge, was when they started putting the fingerprint readers on the phones. So that fingerprint reader was serialized, and it was tied to the phone. So if you tried to replace the fingerprint reader with an aftermarket one, or maybe you had a good one from a different phone that you wanted to swap into this phone, it wouldn't work.
Hmm.
Like the software on the phone would not allow that swap.
Was that a security feature, or was that a
It was Apple. It was Apple trying to stop it. Yeah. They'll say it's security. Yeah. Apple will say it's a security.
That was the first thing that popped into my head. It kind of makes sense, right? I mean,
and I think there is a smidgen of truth there, because I do think it is a chip on the fingerprint reader that stores the fingerprint data. So they wanted to link those together. That was the first one. There's probably a legitimate security reason for that. But then they started doing with all of the components, with the speaker and the buttons and all these different little circuits that are in there, making it very, very difficult for even just regular consumers who want to maybe tinker with their phones and open it up and replace a battery or replace a component, making it very difficult for them to do that. And a lot of the right to repair advocacy groups, Kyle Weens, I'll throw him a, and I might be saying his last name wrong, but I'll mention him. He's with iFixit, and that's a really great company. I had a conversation with him early in my days with Clover, but they develop like repair guides for iPhones, and they sell spare parts, and they are a huge advocate for these right to repair laws, which basically, fundamentally, they're just trying to say, look, people should have the right to fix their stuff, and they should have access to spare parts, and they should have, and this is another big one, access to some of the diagnostic tools that are out there that are available to like authorized dealers who are doing this repair work. Because like I said, the software is what is preventing this replacement part from working in the phone. So you have to have for sort of your everyday, tinkerer to be able to fix some of these devices, they need to have the ability to load up the software, reprogram the devices, and sync everything back together. The other really interesting area where this comes up is with farmers and tractors, because the tractors are now very computerized. All the GPS data, all of those components, there's that's the other big group. It's kind of like iPhones and tractors. It's really where the right to repair legislation
historically
meets the road.
Self-repair guys, right? Yeah. You know, guys who are used to that, a whole culture that's used to that.
Yeah. Wasn't there something like that in the 80s with Apple too, or was it Apple versus IBM and the PC stuff in the late 80s where Apple had, you know, I don't know how to describe it exactly, but they had a very closed system, proprietary, like they didn't want you monkeying around in there, whereas the IBM PCs, you know, they had aftermarket third-party manufacturers, and you could use their components in IBM computers, and it, you know, it was a pretty important bit. As I recall, there was some important business decision.
Yeah, I mean, the PC compatible computers, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's making computers that Microsoft's operating system worked on, whereas Apple had a proprietary operating system.
Well, and I think, I mean, that it's been that way forever. I think that's always been depending on whether you're an Apple fan or not, right? That's one of the biggest things. Like, it's a totally closed system. Like, you can't. Apple's very protective. It's the walled garden, so to speak, right? If you want to get your program on an Apple device, you have to go through Apple, unless you're doing untoward things like jailbreaking phones and things like that. Whereas PCs have always traditionally been, you know, I can pick this processor and this hard drive and this memory, and you can put it all together and have a functional computer. You've never been able to do that with Apple. Mm.
So, like I said in the beginning, we don't want to dwell on this, but the last piece of your story we should at least talk briefly about, which is now you, as of, a month ago?
Close to a month. Was it the 27th? What was the first?
November, moved to Hanson Reynolds, and you can give a little bit about what your plans are at Hanson Reynolds.
Yeah. Very excited to be working with you guys again,
bet
two of the lawyers. Two lawyers who I looked up, I like I said, certainly looked up to Toby. Tim was a summer associate, so
we're more like peers.
Yeah, even though I hadn't even attended law school at the time, excited to be joining such a talented group of attorneys and to be kind of starting down this new path for the firm. You know, we're looking to. Build it out strategically. I think we've got some good clients that are already feeding us some of the prosecution work, and there's some infrastructure to get in place. But certainly between myself and again Toby is also a patent attorney, and we have one other on staff, Jeremy Adelson, right now, who's also available to prosecute. Oh, and Niall. In Minnesota,
Neil.
Right? Neil. Yeah. Yep. We have the core team in place, we're looking forward to bringing on some friends as clients potentially, and some new clients, and again, just provide the best service that we can, and maybe do some creative things. Given our respective backgrounds, I've served in that general counsel role. I've been in the chair where, I'm reviewing the bills and I'm thinking about, the IP strategy and how does that, connect with, vendor contracts and customer contracts and how do the indemnifications all layer out, as you're building up a complicated, manufactured product. Are your vendors going to stand behind the components that they're giving you, where the components might be the basis for an infringement claim? Just thinking about things at a holistic level like that, where I hope to add some value, maybe above and beyond simply getting the patent applications, and then also having access to you guys, some experienced litigators who have seen all kinds of things in contracts and how. How the contractual language can, make or break certain deals and whether a product is successful or not. So just with that team and with the sort of diverse backgrounds that we have, I think we have a lot to offer our clients.
Well, we've always said, you know, there's no better discipline than litigation to review everything once it's done, you know, your suite of contracts, you know, all that kind of stuff, because that's our whole job, is to destroy what you've worked so hard to create.
Right.
So
right.
we know where all the landmines are, you
yeah.
know,
yeah.
and it's that I think that's an important part of what we'll be doing.
Yeah. I look forward to handing Tim, hey Tim, I think this contract is great. And then having him absolutely tear it to shreds.
Exactly.
To the benefit of our client.
To the benefit of the client.
He looks forward to it too.
Yes. Can't wait.
But no, I think we're all excited because as we've talked, even on some of these podcasts, we've always stuck to pure litigation or some, you know, pre-litigation kinds of things. So patent prosecution, although it will include like some just strategic thinking and counseling type things that you're talking about, pure patent prosecution is really the first time we've gone into just an entirely yeah. different practice area.
Big yeah. change. Big right. change.
And at the end of the day, it's still my favorite thing to do. Like, yeah. I
in the law or yeah, in general?
Okay. Yes.
Well, in I'd the rather law. Write an application yeah, than race a car.
No, whatever. Yes, car racing. We haven't touched on that, have we?
That's next.
Yeah. No, but I have really missed sitting down as often as I used to and learning about an invention and sitting down with the inventors and really kind of getting in their heads and understanding, you know, what it is about this thing that they've created that makes it unique and that is going to be patentable, and then just kind of working with them to zero in on. So what is it? What's the most strategic way to protect this thing, you know, and how are we going to do that? Whether that's, you know, utility patents, design patents, some combination of the two. I'm excited to ramp up that part of my practice again.
Good.
Sweet. Let's talk about car racing.
Yeah, just general Matt stuff. Well, first of all, have you lived in Illinois long enough to become a Bears fan? Or?
Absolutely not. Okay. No. No, and we're making sure that the kids are never going to be Bears fans either. We're sabotaging them.
All Raiders all the time, right?
Yeah, right.
Is that true? Are you in one of those families? Is Terry a Bears fan?
No, Terry okay. was never really. So she grew up in St. Louis. Right. Terry's my wife, everyone. Terry grew up in St. Louis, which... And she was never really a football fan to begin with. But, I mean, they of course, had the St. Louis Rams for a while
yep.
there.
Yeah.
Was it the late 90s?
Early 2000s, yeah.
The greatest show on turf, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, there was that. But she never really had much allegiance
okay.
to any particular football team because I think they were pretty short-lived. I don't know. I don't love it, but they seem to be getting the Cubs through osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a huge enough baseball fan to really fight that one off. But when it comes to Packers Bears, yes, there's no tolerance for any sympathy being shown towards the Bears whatsoever.
Well, sometimes you get one kid, you know, who that sticks with, and the other kid is just, you know, going with the flow at school. And so they become a Bears fan and you kind of hard to navigate that world.
But no, yeah, we've been so yeah. I mean, I've been in Chicago since 2006.
Wow.
Well, not Chicago proper anymore. Chicago suburb now. But yeah, that's where we are, and that's where we're going to stay for the foreseeable future. So
sounds good. What are the car racing opportunities in Chicago?
Well, there's this wonderful place in Joliet called Audubon Country Club. And it is essentially a country club.
Is it the only wonderful place in Joliet?
possibly. I might get in trouble for saying that. You know what? There's a good brewery there. The name of it slips my mind right now. But we ate there and drank their beer once after a day of racing. It was very good.
Most of our listenership comes from Joliet, so I'm glad you cleaned that up.
Sorry, Joliet.
So, no, Audubon Country Club. It's a country club, but instead of a golf course, they have two separate racetracks that could actually, if you reconfigure them, they're combined into one racetrack. And so while I'm not a member, there are lots of opportunities to race there with different organizations. Gosh, it was about 6 years ago now, I met my wife had been telling me, she's like, you got to meet this guy. He's a car guy. You got to meet him. And we went to this charity event in our town and met him, and we started talking. And there's this race series called the 24 Hours of Lemons. And this was started, it's probably going on 20 years ago now, out in California. And the premise was endurance racing for $500 cars. And so
the races last 20 minutes.
Way back in the day, they were very strict about that $500 limit. You had to have documentation. The races were total chaos. They've matured over the years. It's actually become one of the more successful, what you would call grassroots racing organizations in the country. They sell out races all over the country, almost every weekend, hundreds of cars in many of these races. And the premise is still cheap, shitty cars, but you can fudge that a little bit. And there's ways around that. And so anyway, he and I were talking. I was like, I've always wanted to do that. He's like, me too. Like, let's do it. And like a month later, I found a 1992 BMW 325 being sold out of Milwaukee here that my brother went and picked up and talked the guy down to $350.
Wow.
So we bought this. It had no clutch. Somehow I drove it home and did not die. And we took it apart, had some great teammates, some great help, and built it into a race car. And the first race we did, it ended up blowing up on the second day and all that. And it was slow and it handled like shit. But we just kind of stuck to it. We built it up over the years. And by the end, by our fourth or fifth year, we were finishing top five pretty much every race. We finished second. That was our best ever finish so far. That's been a lot of fun. 24 Hours of Lemons.
Is that still, you don't still have that car, do you?
No, we sold that car and we're building one.
Was that Dr. Teeth?
Yes, that okay. was Dr. Teeth. So yes, the theme of you're in Lemons, you're encouraged to have a theme of your car. And the more obscure, the better. Or the more outrageous, the better. So, I mean, there's been all kinds of different. There's a Honey Badger car. There's Team Orca, which is a play on Oracle Red Bull Racing, the F1 team, but their car is done up in Red Bull colors, except instead of Red Bull, it says bullshit, and the bull is like taking a dump.
Speaking of intellectual property issues.
Right, yeah. Parody, Tim. All good. Not a problem. But Lemons is a lot of fun. We kind of cut our teeth there. I still race Lemons with another team that runs a car. That car is actually very cool. It's a, let's say, 92 Camaro that they've rebodied to look like a Cadillac.
Sweet.
So that...
What was Dr. Teeth?
Dr. Teeth that was from? BMW. Oh, no. So the original, the first race we ran was over at Gingerman Raceway, which is South Haven, Michigan. John Bush's vacation grounds.
Yeah. Law firm partner John Bush.
Yes.
Podcast guest John Bush.
Indeed. And a lovely little racetrack over there called Gingerman Raceway. And that was the first race that we were going to participate in. We were trying to come up with theme ideas. And what Lemons called the race was the cure for gingivitis. Play on Gingerman, gingivitis. Now you've got this, I'm like, oh, tooth, dental, something like that. Anyway, so Dr. Teeth is sort of where we landed. And we're like, Dr. Teeth, I'm like, I couldn't even remember what he looked like from the Muppets, right? I mean, that's what I remember
him from.
That's what
I say, Sesame Street,
the Muppet Show.
You see the keyboard player?
Yeah, it was the band. So Animal was the drummer,
right?
And then Dr. Teeth was like the lead singer.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember the other characters' names. There was like a girl who played the bass and this blue guy who I think was the guitarist. And anyway, we looked up a picture of him. Because I couldn't really remember what he looked like. I'm like, what about Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem? Wasn't that the band? Yeah, we looked at him. We're like, oh, yeah, that's good. So we made the car look like Dr. Teeth.
That's awesome.
It's one of those things. Like, I had just kind of sketched it out. I found like a three view, side, front, top view of our car. And I just kind of sketched it out with colored pencils. And I'm like, oh, that looks pretty good. Like, what I put on the paper and what came out in real life were like identical. I did not expect it to come out as well as it did. We used you know, those spray foam cans of insulation, you know, like that expands. We made the beard out of that. So we just went down the fender, kind of zigzagging the spray foam. And it made this very compelling, sort of realistic looking beard on a car. And that is kind of Lemons in a nutshell.
So what's the top speed of a car like that?
That car was actually not the fastest car. I think the fastest we ever got that car up to was probably 110, maybe 115. The other car I race with, the Cadmero, as they call it, the Cadillac Camaro, much larger engine, a lot more horsepower. I just raced that car at Road America in September, and we were touching 135 on the on the straights there at Road America, which has some very large, long straights.
So, you have to get us the race schedule when you're at Road America.
I will.
We'll go up there.
Happy to.
Yeah. I got a buddy who races up there. We'll
throw some sponsorship on
real
the cars.
Car. Yeah, we'll put the At The Bar logo on your car.
Well, we're building, so one of my teammates, his name is Ben, and he goes back to, all the way back to that Mustang team that I mentioned, what, an hour ago now? How long have we been going?
Feels like an hour.
all the way back there. So I had worked with Ben at that team. I hadn't seen Ben for 20 years when I decided to start this race team. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to call Ben. And I reached out to him. He's like, yeah, I'm in. And it was like, not, you know, we had just seen each other yesterday. And so Ben actually is, and I'm going to get his title wrong, so he'd probably be mad at me, but Ben kind of runs the shop at a, it's called Muscle Car Restorations, and they do exactly what their name implies. Very high-end shop that restores muscle cars up in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And so I had this harebrained idea that a Datsun with a BMW engine would be really, a really great, great race car. And so that's what we're working on right now. And that's up there with him. And he's working on that. We've gotten a lot of great support from the owner, of the business up there. That's so that's,
I would have thought you'd go the other way, put the rotary right rocket in a Beamer.
No, it's I won't go into the details of why it's a good combination, but, no, we're excited about it. Hope to have it ready for the next season.
Well, I think we should actually sponsor that vehicle.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I would do it.
So anytime these things come up,
that'll be $25,000. Yeah, right.
Anytime these things come up, I always got to pick Tim's brain because Tim and I were born within 2 weeks of each other. But so did you, when you were in kindergarten, have, I think they were like small, like blow up figures for each letter of the alphabet to learn the letter of the alphabet?
Like inflatable ones?
I think they were inflatable. They were like, there was like Mr. T teeth. There was like Miss M mouth, I think, and there were these characters to teach you your letters in kindergarten.
But I grew up in California. It was probably like some kind of, it was regulated out of
existence. Yeah, probably. They're already becoming problematic. But there's things like that are these little niches in time where I wonder if those were used for like 1 year by, and you know how they were like kindergarten in a kit that they sell to every public school around the country, and they all have the same junk in there, and then they teach you out of those. The letters. The one that I'm always fascinated is that, and I don't think this worked with Tim, but in the Midwest, I've run into many people that this is the case. Sophomore year of, it was like sixth grade, I think. There is an English book that circulated all around the Midwest, at least, and most of the country, but I've asked you about this, and it doesn't sound like it hit California, where they had a spelling error for the word dilemma, and it was D-I-L-E-M-N-A, dilemma. And there's a whole generation of people who got that book who for years spelled dilemma. And I mean, I literally in my mind even think dilemma because it was, you know, in a list of words of the week, and then you had a spelling test and dilemma. And I've run into people, I remember being in a bar in New York City talking to people about this, and they're like, I said, how do you spell dilemma? And they said D-I-L-E-M-N-A very officiously and like confident about it. Like, no, wrong.
Yeah.
How old are you? I was, you know, born in 1971. I was like, that's your problem. There were some things about it that kind of made sense. And so people didn't question it as fourth graders or sixth graders or whatever age it was. You know, you'd learned how to spell this word. It forever carried out. And it's not a word that you probably use a ton. So yeah. And this is in the days,
of
course.
Does it have two M's? One of the standards?
Two M's, yeah. And it's in the days before, you know, any sort of computerized spelling.
Yeah, nobody, right? You couldn't look it up.
Yeah.
And you know, God forbid you go pull out an actual dictionary, right? You just take the word or whatever textbook gets put in front of you.
Yeah, finally in 2010, that word is always underlined in red on my emails. You know? there's somebody checking my spelling now. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we've gone long enough, and sure. I don't know if that's exactly the way to end, but we always kind of end, what's your favorite drink? What's your drink of choice since this is at the bar?
Well, I waffle. They're so similar, but it's between a brandy Manhattan or an old fashioned, or a bourbon old fashioned.
That's interesting. So a bourbon old fashioned, but a brandy Manhattan.
Yes.
Not a brandy old fashioned.
I mean, I like brandy old fashions too, but if it's an old fashioned, I prefer the bourbon.
Interesting.
Yes.
Do you ever get caught up in the bourbon craze?
No, not really. Kind of, I mean, yeah. I like good bourbon, but I don't go out of my way to find something that, you know.
It's a whole cult, barrel. Man. Yeah, you could go down that rabbit hole for sure.
Yeah.
Is the brandy old-fashioned only a Wisconsin thing? Or is that?
I don't know if it's only, but that's where it's definitely
It is fundamentally famous. A Wisconsin thing. So I was on a family trip. I was probably, I don't think I was quite old enough to drink. So I was probably 18 or 19. We went to New York with the family pre 9/11. And we were there. We went to the Smith and Walensky's. And I remember we're sitting there. It was my family and Brandy Manhattan is my dad's drink also. And my brothers and both my brothers. So it's a family thing. But anyway, so we're at the Smith and Walensky, you know, nice New York steakhouse. We sit down, and my dad, you know, goes around the horn and gets to my dad's like, "What would you like, sir?" And he's like, "A brandy Manhattan, Korbel, if you have it." And the waiter's like, "Yes, sir. Just a moment, sir." And the waiter goes back, and he gets like a trainee or something, and he brings this kind of kid up, and he's like, "This gentleman just ordered a brandy Manhattan. Where is he from?"
Yeah.
And the kid's like, "South Carolina."
Yeah.
The guy's like, "No, he's from Wisconsin," and we're like, "Oh my God, you're right." But like, so that was, you know, again, a probably lifelong, high-end restaurant in New York. And he knew that if somebody ordered a brandy Manhattan,
that's a Wisconsin
they were very, very likely from Wisconsin.
Dear listeners, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read somewhere where Wisconsin accounts for something like 75% of the consumption of brandy in the United States.
That is, I think that's absolutely true. Yes.
Well, remember, you and I were in New York, Tim, and we were wondering, is there anything you can't get on the island of Manhattan, right? Especially food, like any kind of food you wanted somewhere. And the one thing we came up with, because we were trying to think of like real weird Wisconsin-specific things, and I was like, I wonder if you could get a perch fry somewhere in New York City.
That's a good one.
And I'm not sure you can. That might be one thing you cannot find anywhere on the island of Manhattan. Now, maybe you can, but that'd be one that would be a little bit hard. I don't know if you went and ordered a brandy old fashioned sour, like if you were real specific, if bartenders in Manhattan would know what you're talking about, probably. But,
yeah, maybe the good ones would. I'm sure you'd stump.
But there are some unique Wisconsin things that might
fried
not be found
anywhere. Fried cheese curds, you could probably find it, but not everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, but now the only thing is Culver's now is all over the place. Culver's has really gotten far and wide. Mm. So I bet you I don't know if there's Culver's in Manhattan, but there probably are. There are on the East Coast, I know.
I don't know if they've gotten that far yet. Yeah.
They're on the East Coast. I know that.
Mm. Well, there you go. Mm-hmm. Entered on a true Wisconsin note.
Yep.
Welcome aboard, buddy.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks
Happy
for joining
me. Happy to be here. Thank you, guys.